record.
Right. I mean, you could have done that. You got it.
Yeah, I'll use this one. I'll use one of these.
Oh, okay. Is there anything you need right now? Is there anything, second question, is there anything you need during the week?
No, that's good. Thank you.
Nothing. Water?
No, I think, thank God.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
If something comes up, please. I'm
sure.
100% serious.
I appreciate it.
Anything. Errands? It is.
Thank you. Sure. Yeah. Finals at the end of the week.
Oh, no. Hi. I'm Cheryl Rod Bell. I have to...
Cheryl.
Rod Bell.
Nice to meet you.
And I was here this morning. I really
enjoyed it. Yeah, so you're... No.
Sorry I haven't been able to come before this point.
No problem.
And I'm leaving town again, so I'm not getting to hear very much, but I really enjoyed it.
Oh, good. I'm glad. Thank you very much. Okay, good evening. Welcome, everyone. I must say I'm really enjoying Atlanta. We're at the zoo today, and I was extremely impressed that they sell deer at the zoo. This is, like, fantastic. I mean, I've never been to a zoo. They sell deer. Even in Australia, they don't do that. It's, like, fantastic. I'm like, yeah, it's, like, awesome. And people are moving here. Anyway, at least to the zoo. We're talking about free will, gangster Judaism, free will, and gang warfare in the First World War, etc. Hopefully it will become clear to you as the class progresses why I called it that way. So it was Groucho Marx who commented, he says, we must believe in free will, we have no choice. But just a few points about free will, as an introduction. First of all, in order to have a concept of morality, must require the concept of free will. Pretty clear example. I could not call someone good or evil if that person's action could not be traced to the person themselves. If you can trace their action to some source outside themselves, then obviously it's not them doing it, and therefore they're neither good nor evil. So for example, marine biologists have found overwhelming evidence that dolphins torture their young. Woodhull Marine Institute, they have found evidence of young dolphins with horrific injuries that were clearly caused by the teeth and snouts of older dolphins. Dolphins torture their young, abuse them. Right? In addition to which, dolphins regularly torture harbor seals and leave them to die half-drowning in the water. They don't eat them. They just have some fun with them. Right? They cripple them and then they leave them, you know, in the water and they drown. Now, are dolphins evil? Are dolphins evil? I mean, they're doing things which if any of us, God forbid, would do this, if you would torture a harbor seal, right, you'd be in prison quicker than if you tortured a human being. Right? I mean, hurting a child, I mean, God forbid, I mean, this is terrific stuff. But the answer is dolphin is clearly not evil, because dolphin is an instinctive creature. Dolphins have no free will. They operate by instinct. If they happen to save a person, it's because of a herd instinct. There's not been very many documented cases of that either. Right? Dolphins in the wild bite people. Right? They have very sharp teeth. People think, oh, look at that smile, and then you get eaten. Right? So it's not, they fool you. Right? So I've got nothing against dolphins per se. I'm just saying that dolphins are not creatures of free will. A pit bull is not evil if it attacks someone. Its owner may be evil, right? But the pit bull is not evil. Difference between the pit bull and the social worker? Pit bull gives the kid back. Doesn't matter. Anyway, any social workers here? I'm sorry. Okay, I don't feel I've completed the class unless I've insulted someone at some point. Okay, so I'm Australian as part of the. I'd lose my citizenship if I don't do that. So anyway, angels, or rather dolphins, therefore pit bulls, etc., have no free will. These are creatures that operate on instinct. Angels, in addition, also have no free will. What do we call angels? One of the names for angels in Hebrew, we said it this morning during davening, during our prayers, is Chayot HaKodesh. Now, what does Chayot HaKodesh mean? What is a Chaya? Animal. Kodesh? Holy animals. This sounds like the name of the Yeshiva football team. You know what I'm saying? The holy animals. Like, so, that's not a bad idea, actually. So, but Chayot HaKodesh is what we call angels. Why do we call angels Chayot HaKodesh, holy animals? Rav Chaim Volozhin says, very simply says, because inasmuch as they are spiritual beings, they are holy. Inasmuch as they have no free will, they are animals. They cannot go up and down the spiritual God. You know, it's interesting, Rav Cook points this out. In our Shemona Esrei silent prayer, you stand with your feet together. Everyone knows that? You stand with your feet together at attention, right? Feet together. Why do you stand with your feet together? What does it say in the code of Jewish law? Anyone know? To be like the angels. Because Ezekiel describes the angels as being as though they had one foot. Does that make sense to anyone? Like, what is that? Angels have one foot, pogo angels. What is the idea of an angel with one foot? Right, they've got two feet, but they're standing with their feet together, so it looks like one foot. So what does that mean to me? Yechezkel says, okay, it's a rhetorical question, I get paid to answer it. So anyway, so Yechezkel says the following. So that's what Yechezkel says, they've got two feet and they look like they've got one foot because they're together. So again, Rav Cook explains in the following way, he says, because angels are immobilized. You see, when you stand with your feet together, you can't normally walk, that's not normal range of human motions, not with your feet together. That's immobilization, right? The idea of the angels standing with their feet together is an indication of their being immobilized. They cannot move up and down the spiritual or moral scale. They cannot choose to do one thing or the other. Right, a human being, one of the names for a human being in the Torah is, God says to Moses, "V'natati lecha mehalchim bein ha'omdim ha'ela." I will give you the ability to walk amongst those who are stationary. He tells Moses, when you go up to heaven, I'll let you walk amongst the stationary beings. Who are the stationary beings? The angels. So the human is called a walker, mehalech, ambulatory. Right, the idea of that is that we have got the ability to move up and down on the spiritual, moral, ethical scale. Angels don't. And that's why, in the words of my Rebbe, Rav Moshe Shapira, I'll say it in Hebrew because it's very beautiful in Hebrew, but he says, definition of a human being, he says, is regel achat v'sha'ol tachtit, regel achat v'rakia shvi'it, which means one foot in the depths of hell, one foot in the seventh heaven. Right? It just sounds better in Hebrew. In English it sounds like I'm a preacher on Sunday morning. You know, so, but that's the idea. Because a human being uniquely is a creature who can do either good or unspeakable evil. And that is what makes us unique. And of course, it is that ability of free will which is what makes the concept of good and evil existing. Right? If you could, let's say I was under post-hypnotic suggestion that at 11 o'clock tonight, my hand would just shoot out like that. I didn't realize this, but someone hypnotized me, and so I'm at someone's house, and they're showing me around. He says, I've got to show you something. I just bought this at Sotheby's auction in London just last week. It's a Ming Dynasty vase. I got it at absolutely fantastic price, £1.2 million sterling. Right? And here it is. And I'm like, oh, that's beautiful. Wham! Right? What are you doing? I said, what do I do? What are you doing something? Now, I don't know if legally I am liable for the Ming vase, but morally, am I liable for it? What would you say? I would think not. In a deterministic system, if you are born a certain way and that is how you will be, you're not evil. You know, if it was predestined that you were born in a certain environment and that is a genes, environment, etc., etc., and you would therefore become an Arab terrorist, and that is inevitable, then you're not evil. You're just doing what you're just playing out your programming. And if it was, you know, you were born into a family of Irish people in New York and you inevitably become a policeman, right, and you run into the building to save people, then it doesn't mean a thing. It's just pre-programmed. So, of course, people like to always accept responsibility for the good that they've done and blame the evil on something else, right? You ever heard that? If I've done something good, I would like to be praised for that. But if I did something wrong, I'd like my parents to be criticized for that, right? If I did something wrong, it's clearly a result of my upbringing. It is clearly a result of my genes. It's clearly a result of something else. I mean, it's, people always, you know, people get religious when they're blaming God for something. He made me that way. It's not my fault. I remember I was in Bethlehem. So standing outside the base, waiting for a hitch, there's always a little bit of a problem is whether you get the hitch or the bus. Because the bus is infinitely more uncomfortable than a hitch in a car, right? The bus stop was about 100 meters away. And you could stay at, but there was not, but the bus was reliable. It would come every half hour. Hitch is not reliable. A trump in Hebrew is not reliable. So I would usually stand at the trumpiata where you get the hitch. And then if I heard the diesel engine of the air bus come around the corner, sprint like a madman, right? It's not hard for me. That is the madman part, not the sprinting. And sprint for like a madman for the bus stop. Because he will not stop for you unless you're at the bus stop. As you know, Egged bus drivers are trained. If you're at the bus stop, will they stop? If you're almost there, they'll slow down so as not to discourage you. But they'll just go right past as soon as you, right, Anyway, they may stop a little bit so you make your last surge before the heart attack to get it, right, but that's it. Right, so anyway, that was always the moral quandary. Do I wait for the hitch? Do I get the bus? So anyway, I'm standing outside the base. I've decided, I hear the motor, I'm going for the bus. But I'm waiting at the trumpiata. So now, outside the base, the rule was you're supposed to carry your gun at ready with a magazine in it. I'm not referring to Newsweek here, right? So you're supposed to carry your gun at the ready with a magazine in it. So I'm standing outside, and a guy comes out the base. He's got his gun behind his back, magazines in his pocket. He's got a bag in both hands and a backpack over his gun. You understand? His gun would have taken him a good 15 minutes to get to it. I mean, 15 minutes would be optimistic, right? So he's standing there, and I look at him, and I'm standing like this, and he's standing there, and I say, Javier. I said, friend, this is, you know, you're supposed to have your gun at the ready. He says, He says, and he's not wearing a kippah, right? He says, He says, if God wants me to go, it's not going to help to have the gun. He says, and if he doesn't want me to go, he says, I don't need the gun. So I'm about to refute him when I hear the engine of the bus. So I run for the bus stop. I get there. I stand there at the bus stop in the normal way you stand there to stop an egghead bus. Right, etc. Throw myself in front of the wheel. Right, that type of thing. And I get on the bus, and behind me, I hear this gasping and wheezing. This guy is on the bus behind me. He gets on the bus. I turn around to him. I said, "You ran for the bus?" He says, "Beth, sure." I said, "I don't understand it. If God wanted you to get the bus, you wouldn't need to run. And if He didn't want you to get the bus, running wouldn't help." He says, "He says, ani lo tati." I'm not religious. I said, well, 30 seconds ago, you were profoundly religious. You know what I mean? 30 seconds ago, you were so religious that you didn't care about your life. So, you know, that's the way people are. When it is convenient to blame it on God and divine providence or on other causes, I'll do it. When it is not convenient, then I will take the, I'll take the credit, but I won't take the blame. Well, free will works. That is both ways. You have to take the credit. You can take the credit if you do good, and you can take, you must take the blame if you do the opposite. And indeed, the Torah, one of the central principles Maimonides says of all of Judaism, and the truth is of all religions, I would say, and probably of all moral systems, is the idea that there is free will. I have called heaven and earth today as witnesses against you. I have set life and death before you, blessing and curse. Choose life so you and your descendants will live. And very, very clear, Maimonides in many, many places talks about how important and central free will is in Jewish tradition. Man is given the option, if he so wishes, of taking the path of goodness and becoming righteous, or if he so wishes, of taking the path of evil and becoming wicked. This is a major principle and is the foundation of the Torah and of the commandments. A person can choose to do any activity he wants, whether good or bad. I should point out at this moment that there are some people who have a misunderstanding here. I've often been asked this, and it's a basic logical misunderstanding of what we mean by free will. At this point, someone will ask, So if that's true, if I choose to do the wrong thing, if I choose to steal, or if I choose to have the cheeseburger, or if I choose to take your parking spot, he says, surely that's part of free will, isn't it? And it should be okay to do it. What's his mistake? You hear the question? If you don't hear the question, that's good. But if you understand the question, he's asking that if you're telling me man is given the option to choose any activity, good or bad, he says, then how can you blame me if I chose the wrong thing? So here the mistake such a person is making is the following. It's a very careful, very important point to make. Right? The mistake he's making is, his assumption is free will means that anything I choose is by virtue of the fact that I chose it, okay, morally correct. Anything I choose by virtue of the fact that I chose it is fine. That's not what free will means. That definition is a definition that says there's no such thing as good and evil. Right? That's what you call complete moral autonomy. That is to say, I am the decider. Right? Anything I choose to do by virtue of the fact that I chose it is fine. That's not what we mean by free will. That would mean that there's nothing which is good, nothing which is evil. Anything I choose to do is fine. Because I chose to do it. That's what we mean by free will. Is this clear? This is a very important point. That's not what we mean by free will. What we mean by free will is there is an objective good. And there is an objective evil. There is an absolute good, there is an absolute evil. There are things which are morally good, things which are morally bad. There are consequences to those things. Good and bad consequences. I have the ability, uncoerced, to choose one or the other. God doesn't coerce me into choosing one or the other. But if I do choose one or the other, I have to live with the consequences. And I might choose to do evil, and it is evil. I might choose to do good, and it is good. Is this point very clear? It's a very important point. It's often a stumbling block. A lot of people make that mistake. You know, I often am asked that. College students, for some reason, always ask me that. I dread to think what college campuses are like, but that's what they usually ask me. So anything I choose, I say, no. But that is not what we mean. Free will is the ability to choose between good and evil. Right? And by free will, we mean choice between good and evil. And that, Maimonides says, and this is of course the Talmud, just one second, Talmud says, Hakol bidei shamayim, everything's in the hands of heaven, chutz, except for yirat shamayim, fear of heaven. What is included in yirat shamayim, fear of heaven? All moral, all ethical decisions. Virtually everything that you choose, most things that you choose in life, whom you will marry, is that included in Yirat Shamayim? No? Whom you will marry, is that a question of God? Is that a question which is included under the moral ethical code? Of course it is. Of course it is. I mean, if you choose to marry a Satan worshipper, would that be a good choice? I mean, maybe they didn't fill out the Shidduch form totally correctly, you know what I mean? They forgot the bit about Satan worship, right? Or, I mean, that would be immoral. That would be an immoral choice, right? You are Jewish and choose to marry a non-Jew. That's an immoral, it's a wrong choice, right? So, of course, that enters under free choice, which means God does not influence your decision in that area. That is your decision alone. Whether to go to a physician or not, take care of a medical problem, that under Yirat Shamayim, fear of heaven or not? Of course it is. Are you responsible or are you irresponsible? Are you taking precautions in life or are you not taking precautions? Right? Absolutely. You choose to run a red light. Does that come under Yirat Shamayim, fear of heaven? Of course. Right? Except certain areas in New York, then yeah, running the red light would, whatever, it doesn't matter. But basically, right, this comes under fear of heaven. So most of the things we do, Maimonides points out, come under that. Yes. Well, we're not going to deal with that question, but that's a very famous question. The idea of, I've listed it here, that it says in Ethics of the Father, number 2, all is foreseen and yet free will is granted. All is foreseen and yet free will is granted. Maimonides would say that we don't understand God's essence. Right? It's impossible for the human mind to comprehend God's essence. Which means, when it says God knows, do we understand what that means? Answer is, of course not. I know what it means that you or I know something, but when it says God knows something, his knowledge and his essence are one. He's a total and unique unity. That means I cannot wrap my mind around that. Right? So the idea that God knows something, and the idea that we have the ability to act with free will, those are not contradictions. If I would understand what it meant, God knowing, And I would, so maybe, but I, maybe I don't have a question, but he says, in that sense, it's not really a question. He says, it's God's essence. There are various solutions to it, which have been advanced by various, Rav Yitzchak Al-Moshnino, in his commentary, in the Tiferet Yisrael quotes him in the commentary, and this Mishnah here talks, is a famous answer about God being above time, seeing all of past, present, and future as one moment. Which means, he says, when does God know what I'm doing? At the moment I'm doing it. Because for God, it's all one moment. It's all one moment. Example, a friend of my wife put it, she's a scientist, so she thinks of it this way. She says, let's say you had a hologram. And the hologram, most holograms have three dimensions. Okay. Let's say you had a hologram with four dimensions, i.e., in addition to depth, width, and length, it also had time. So you could have a hologram of 30 years of a person's life. You could look at the hologram, frozen 30 years of a person's life. You would be seeing what that person does in one shot. Let's say you had a hologram of 6,000 years of human moral history. So everything everyone we're doing would be in one shot. That's how God sees it, so to speak. That's the Mori Al-Moshnino says. I should also point out there's a solution which David Hume, based on David Hume, Scottish philosopher, who has the following scenario. Let's say I walk into a hotel room. And it's a cheap hotel, not very good. Right? And as I close the door, or the door has a closing thing, it closes, right? The door jams. Unbeknown to me, I am now locked into my room. I don't know that, but I am locked into the room. Okay, clear? I sit down in the room, and I take out a novel which I've been dying to read, right? And the phone rings. It's a close friend of mine. I say, hey, how you doing? He says, listen, I'm in terrible, terrible trouble. I borrowed some money from a loan shark. Right? He has sent some thugs to beat the daylights out of me. Right? They are going to who knows what. He says, unless I come up with $5,000 by 3 o'clock this afternoon. I say, so what's your point? He says, listen, he says, you're my closest friend. Can you please lend me the $5,000? I said, well, it's a lot of money. He says, they're going to beat me up. They're going to beat me to a pulp. I might die. I said, yeah, there's still $5,000 of money. And he says, you're my closest friend, please. I say, all right, can you meet me at the hotel? He says, okay. I said, I'll come wherever you want. I tell him the hotel. He says, good. I said, 3 o'clock, I'll come downstairs with a check. Don't worry about it. And he says, swear to me. I said, okay, I swear to you. Swear to me on everything you hold holy. I put my hand on a stack of DVDs. I said, okay, fine, yes, absolutely, I will. Right. So, okay. Now, 20 to 3, I'm getting into the book, and I'm thinking to myself, I'm reading it's Ayn Rand. Right. So I'm thinking to myself, he is pathetic. He hasn't taken care of himself. He's not taken responsibility for himself. Why should I support him? Right, here's a, you know, I've been reading Nietzsche, I've been reading Ayn Rand, you know what I mean? I'm not very sympathetic at this moment in my life, right? I mean, even less than I normally am. So anyway, I'm thinking about this guy, and I say to myself, and it's now 2:45, and I say to myself, and $5,000, a lot of money. And then, like 2:50, I'm thinking to myself, hey, if he borrowed money from a loan shark who has thugs and guns, and he hasn't paid it back, why do I think he'd pay me back? It's called a kalvachomer, right? Because if you borrow money from Tony Soprano and don't pay him back, how much more so will you not pay back Mordechai Becher, right? Obviously you don't know me if you wouldn't pay me back, but anyway. But he says, so I think to myself, I'm not going to get this money back, it's over. So by 2:55, I'm like, I don't know. I pull out the plug of the phone. I turn off my cell phone, I turn off the BlackBerry, I turn off my pager, right? I turn off the notebook and the Wi-Fi network, I set it unwired, right? And I say to myself, forget it. He has to take responsibility. He's been doing this since kindergarten, right? So, that's, I mean, you know, loan sharks in kindergarten, he lent me the Lego, you want the Lego, you give me the, right, anyway, that's out of it. So, I say to myself, forget it. About 3 o'clock, I hear some screams, muffled screams through the window of the hotel. I say, I turn up the television a little louder, get back into the book. Right, I said, it's not my responsibility, his fault. Right, I hear some sirens, you know, police sirens, ambulance, fire, and paramedics, you know, that type of stuff, SWAT team, whatever. Right, and anyway, I say, not my fault. Now, what would you say about me at that point? Evil, sick, pervert individual, correct? Absolutely terrible, reprehensible. Anyway, about 3:30, I finish the book. I figured I'll go down and get a drink in the bar. So I go to the room of the hotel. Remember, it jammed when I went into the room, right? I cannot open it. It's absolutely jammed. And it's a cheap hotel. By the time they get security to me, it'll be an hour. So I say to myself, oh, this is fantastic. This is fantastic. I saved $5,000, and since the outcome was predetermined that he would get beaten up anyway, I could not have saved him because the door was jammed. Then I am indeed a righteous person. I'm ecstatic with $5,000 in my bank account now. What would you say? Am I ecstatic? Not in real life, I know I am, but I mean in the story, right? Would you say, look, okay, would you say I'm ecstatic? Why is that funny, Andrew? Excuse me? So the other person laughed about my running up the stairs yesterday. Okay. So what would you say? Is it, am I indeed righteous? Am I righteous? Because, think of it, was the outcome predetermined? Would he have gotten beaten up no matter what? Let's say I would have at 3 o'clock gone to give him the check. I would have, the door's jammed. I would have called security. I'd say, yeah, sure, we'll send the janitor up in about half an hour. Yeah, yeah, that's it. He would have got beaten up anyway. So therefore, the outcome was known and predetermined. And yet, would you say it would be appropriate? I'm sorry? He's downstairs. Right? So now, my question is the following. Am I a righteous individual? No? I would say the following. So David Hume advances his argument. He would say, you have made an evil decision, and you can be punished for that. The consequences were beyond your control. But the decision was within your control, and that is evil. So that's another possibility. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman says something similar to that. I don't know if it's based on David Hume, but whatever. So Rabbi Chanan Wasserman says something similar to that. So anyway, that's another possibility. Of course, Rabbi Bessler has another view. We believe it actually goes beyond that. We believe you're not only responsible for the decision, but you're also responsible for the consequences of your decision. Human, God gave us free will. He gave us power with that free will. Tremendous power. Right, and we have got the power with our free will to affect other people, positively and negatively. Look at the story of Joseph and his brothers. We all know the story. Joseph went to his brothers in Dothan, right, and they saw him in the distance. They said, there's the guy with the technicolor dream coat, let us kill him. Right, and as you know, the Torah says, Reuven heard them and saved him from them. People familiar with that? Pasuk says, Vayishma Reuven vayatzilehu miyadam. Reuven heard and saved him from their hands. What did Reuven say to do? This is an open book test. It says it right here. Reuven said, chuck him in the pit. Then the Torah says, the pit, v'avor reik, ein bo mayim, which means the pit was empty, there was no water in it. Now, the Talmud says, well, if it's empty, duh, there is no water in it. Doesn't say duh, but whatever, you know, it's a pshuta. Right? Of course there is no water in it. So what does it mean? How do you translate it? The pit was empty of water. But a pit in Dothan, I don't think the Dothan, which is empty of water, has snakes and scorpions in it. So now Reuven says, don't kill him. Throw him in the pit with snakes and scorpions. Now, I want to make you aware, the Talmud says that if you see someone fall into a pit with snakes and scorpions, you can actually go to the Beis Din, the court, and testify that he's dead. And his wife can remarry now. Why? Because snakes and scorpions are deadly creatures. Falling into a pit of snakes and scorpions, right, means basically death. So now, let me ask you something. Would anyone here like to be saved by Reuven? I mean, if you had the option, right? The brothers say, let's kill him quickly. Reuven says, no, no. Chuck him in the pit with the snakes and scorpions. Exposure, dehydration, contusions, abrasions, right, breaks, snake bite, scorpion sting, right, much preferable to a quick death at the hands of the brothers. But Reuven my hero? I mean, that's very hard to understand. Right, so the Torah testifies, that means God, testifies that Vayishma Reuven, that Reuven saved him. How do you look at it being saved? So the Zohar, on that place, quoted by the Or HaChaim, Reuven ibn Attar quotes it, says the following, a person should always pray they fall into the hands of snakes and scorpions rather than into the hands of their enemies. Because a human has free will and is much more dangerous than snakes and scorpions. Snakes, and the Rabbi Shapiro explains the Zohar in the following way. said the following. But you see, humans can put you in danger, and in order to get out of that danger, you might need tremendous merit. You might need an open miracle. You might need a lot of merit. An animal only can put you in danger if you're not innocent. To get away, to be saved from the snakes and scorpions, all it requires is innocence. To be saved from human beings, that requires awesome merit. In other words, it's a greater intervention, a greater miracle to save you from a human than to save you from a snake and scorpion. Why? Because a snake has no free will, a human has free will. And since free will is so powerful, God is reluctant to intervene in human free will. He gave us free will. If he'd intervene all the time, how much free will would we have? If it intervened continuously, we'd be rats in the Skinner maze. Right? They're running around pressing levers, right? Getting through pellets or the electroconvulsive therapy, one of the two, and that'll be it. That's not what God wants. He wants sentient beings who think and who make decisions. So if he would intervene, that would take away, detract from our free will, and therefore God is reluctant to intervene in the free will of a human being. And that's what the Zohar says. Always pray that you should not fall into the hands of a human, and rather fall into the hands of so-called natural problems. This is clear, and we actually say this almost every day. We say this in our prayers almost every day. What do we say in our prayers almost every day that says this explicitly? That you should pray to fall into the hands of natural forces rather than into the hands of humans. Because humans require much greater divine intervention. Almost every day. This is for 10 points. No? 10 points. Oh. Double or nothing? Okay. Tachanun. Tachanun. What do we say before Tachanun? Vayomer David El Gad. King David said to God, context here is that King David committed a sin. The prophet Gad goes to King David and says, listen, you've got an option here. You can either fall into the hands of your enemies, or we could have 3 days of plague. What do you prefer? King David says, Vayomer David El Gad. So David says to God, Sarli Ma'od. This is really distressing. Niplana b'yad Hashem ki rabim rachamav. Let us fall into the hands of God, for his mercy is abundant. U'b'yad Adam, into the hands of a human, ale pola. Don't let me fall into the hands of humans. That is what King David says to God. Right? Is that clear? Isn't that the same principle? What does King David say? How else do you translate that verse, if not according to the Zohar? Are we following? Everyone clear? Okay, I had a question there. Yes. No, what we are taught is, if a person goes along the long way, God will allow him to do that. What it actually says is, Abat l'tame potchim lo, which means one who comes to do impurity, God opens the way for him. That doesn't mean he helps him. He allows him to do it. He won't stop him. Habala Tahir, one who comes to do purity, Messiah in law, there is help. Because Midat Tova Nuruba, the attribute of goodness, of God's loving kindness, is always greater than the justice. So, but God will let. Now, there are situations where a person can lose their free will. Right? It's not an absolute. There's no guarantee that you'll have free will in every single situation, every single moment of your life. Pharaoh is a classic example. God took away Pharaoh's free will because Pharaoh was such a low life. He had done so much evil that God, according to Maimonides, of course, took away his free will. So anyway, that is a little bit of it. That's the introduction. Yeah.
So, given the example of David, you just told us, the one that Abraham chose slavery, which is our enemy, because I seem to remember he was given a choice of which type of punishment?
He was not given the choice. The Torah says, God tells him, your children will be slaves under the Egyptians. He tells him that. Interesting. There also, God says, your children will be slaves in a land, your children will be strangers in a strange land, and they will afflict them. They will enslave them and afflict them. But it's interesting, right after that it says what? However, gam et hagoy asher ya'avodu dan anochi, that the nation that they serve I will judge. Interesting. So God says, I predict, and I'm telling you that your children will be enslaved in Egypt, but the Egyptians will not get away scot-free. I'm going to punish them. So all the commentaries, Nachmanides, all discuss this. Fascinating. They say the following. What is that verse saying? What it's saying is, because at first you might ask the question, hold on, if the Egyptians were only fulfilling the word of God, God said to Abraham that your children will be enslaved, what were the Egyptians doing when they enslaved the Jews? They were doing a mitzvah. Weren't they? They were fulfilling God. God said to Abraham, Jews will be slaves. The Egyptians fulfilled the command of God. Why should the Egyptians deserve punishment? I'm not going to give you all the answers. There are six answers to this amongst the Rishonim. I'll give you a few. Right? The Ramban, Nachmanides, answers. He says, look, the Egyptians didn't know that God commanded that. They had no clue. They weren't doing it to enslave the Jews. It wasn't like the Egyptians said, look, I'm really sorry, but you know the Torah says that I have to enslave you. Right? So I'm doing it because it hurts me more than it hurts you. Right? They didn't say that. They did it for their own political, material gains. Correct? He says they can't use the excuse. They didn't know the mitzvah. That's number one. Number two answer is given is that, yeah, all God said is enslave them. He didn't say kill them. He didn't say torture them. He didn't say throw their children into the Nile. Did he? So the Egyptians, had they only enslaved the Jews, would not have been punished. They went overboard. Okay? And the answer Maimonides gives is, look, he says God predicted that it would happen because he knew enough Egyptians would make an evil decision that it would actually happen. But he says he didn't coerce any individual Egyptian and say, you are going to enslave the Jews. He didn't say, Ahmed, Boyna. But I didn't say that. He didn't say, come here, you enslave the Jews. He said, the Jews will be enslaved. Why? Because he knew there's enough Egyptians out there who will make the evil decision that he can confidently predict the Jews will be enslaved. Okay, so that's a side point, close parenthesis, you can start listening again. Okay, so now, inasmuch as we see from the above, free will central to morality, central to what the essence of a human being is, central and very powerful, powerful enough to affect others, powerful enough that you need a miracle to escape it, incredibly powerful and very important. The question we have to ask ourselves now is, so much of what we do has nothing to do with free will. How many things do we do which have got nothing to do with free will? Think about it. I get on the plane, the stewardess says, did you order kosher food, sir? I don't know, they always know that I order, right? She says, did you order kosher food, sir? Now, I could say, I'm Amish, right? And so that you have a mustache, I say, I'm Reform Amish. So, whatever. So, but even so, I don't do that, right? When they say, did you order kosher, automatically I say, yeah. I don't even think about it. I have no struggle whatsoever. No struggle. I have been somehow conditioned that I eat kosher. If I have no struggle, where's the free will there? Granted, I could choose the non-kosher. I could. It's within my power. But I don't even think about it. If it doesn't even enter my mind, how could that be considered free will? I'm standing there, I remember coming back off reserve duty, standing there at an ATM in Israel, customer. Okay, and I'm standing in line, customer, with a Galil rifle. And a guy cuts in front of me. I don't know what it's like in the in Atlanta. But in New York, if there was a guy at an ATM with an automatic weapon, would you cut in front of him? Out of your mind? I mean, in Israel, this is normal. Okay, so he cuts in front of me. Now, I will tell you, it never entered my mind to kill him. Why is this so funny? Right? Do you think I would kill him? Okay, I never entered my mind to kill him. I didn't think to myself, he cut in front of me, shall I kill him? I didn't have a struggle. Maybe just jab him in the kidney with the barrel or clavicle with the butt of the rifle. Not lethal, but very painful. Right? I mean, is that what I didn't enter my mind to do any of these things. Right? Is that amazing? It's not amazing. I have been brainwashed in non-violence. I've tried my best to go against my brainwashing, but I have basically been brainwashed in non-violence. On the Becher desktop, right, on the drop-down menu which says response to obnoxiousness, right, I cannot highlight kill. I just have to press the mouse, doesn't highlight it. Right, you know, it's got clear throat, that's the English word. Right, clear throat, it says, say something, excuse me, right, that type of thing, but it doesn't say kill, right? So, you know, so where is my free will? And there are a lot of things that we do which are good. We do out of rote. There are a lot of things which we avoid which are bad, but the reason we avoid them is not because we made a free will decision about it, it's because I was educated that way. And on the other hand, there are a lot of things which I do which are wrong, which I don't think about much either. A lot of people, I remember a guy came to our seminar, I told him about the Sefer Chafetz Chaim, a book by a great sage, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, I'm sure you've heard of him, about the ethics of speech, not to speak badly about other people. So this guy, I'll tell you his real name afterwards, this guy says to me, he says, what do you mean, this is a book about how to speak? I said, yeah. He says, he laughed his head off. I said, what are you laughing at? He says, how can you legislate speech? It's like legislating breathing. You can't legislate that. He says, nothing could be more natural than talking about someone else. He says, how could you legislate? It's ridiculous. So he keeps absolutely incredulous. For him, did he go through a free will struggle when he spoke Lashon Hara about someone, when he spoke about someone badly? You think there was any struggle? Like, the idea that this could be even legislated was something which was shocking to him. So where's the free will? So the answer is this. First World War. I've got a diagram of the First World War down the bottom there. It's not to scale. Right. So, during the First World War, as you know, as a hobby, I study weapons and military history and stuff like that. But anyway, First World War is very much trench warfare. Right. So you had some pathetic place in the middle of Belgium. There's two trenches, a few hundred yards apart. One trench has got British troops, and the other trench has got German troops. Okay, Germans and their allies, the British and their allies. And they're in this trench. And occasionally they come up and they shoot at each other, and they've got their little periscope things, and they occasionally make a charge, but really the trenches move a little bit that way, a little bit that way. Now, if you go all the way back to Berlin, there's not much of a war happening in Berlin. There's no fighting in Berlin. Right? That is territory which is securely under the rule of the Germans. If you go to London, there's not much fighting happening. I mean, the occasional Zeppelin. But there's not much fighting in London. Right? And there's not much of a war there. That is under the control of England, the Queen, or the King at that time. Right? So it was not a problem. Right? Where was the war? At the trenches. Was it clear, folks? You getting the picture? Right. So now those trenches would occasionally move one way or the other. If the French were at the front line, they'd generally be moving back. Right? If it was the British, they'd move forward a bit. It's such joy out of the French losing the World Cup. I cannot tell you how much joy that gave. And one of the main reasons they lost was they were obnoxious. Right? Because the French captain headbutted someone and got thrown off the field. Right? He's the total French hero. Demoralized the team. He didn't score that thing. And they lost this unbelievable. I get such joy. What's that?
She's always there when she needs
it. That's right, yes. They have four levels of terror alerts in France. Like here you've got the red, the green, the orange, and that type of stuff. So in France they also have. The first is run. The second highest terror load is hide. The third is capitulate. And the highest level of terror load is collaborate. So in any case, so you've got this. So any with French people here? Okay. Maybe there's a French social worker here. That would be ideal. French social worker who plays soccer. Okay. Anyway, so now, works like this. An Egyptian French social worker who... getting carried away. So now, you've got a situation where the war is really at the trenches, between those two trenches. And as they move back and forth, you're capturing more or less territory, right? It will be a disaster if you were fighting at the gates of London. You know what I mean? If you have to fight at London against the Germans, that would be like disastrous, right? It would be wonderful if the English forces were all the way at Berlin, wouldn't it? Right, but that's not how it happened during the First World War. So what Redesler says is, this is how free will works exactly like the First World War. There are areas of your life which are conquered territory, either by the forces of good or by the forces of evil. Right, either. There are areas of your life that you keep kosher, that I don't steal, that I don't murder, I don't become violent. That's conquered territory. I don't really have a struggle with that. There are other areas of my life which are still controlled by the Germans, i.e., like areas like Lashon Hara, maybe, like subtle areas of ethics, which are really, I don't have a struggle there yet. Okay? Where is my battle? In between the two. Is this clear, folks? Let me make it clearer by using a contemporary example. I live in Passaic, New Jersey, which is not far from a beautiful city called Newark, New Jersey. Newark, New Jersey is the home to two American youth groups One is called the Crips, the other is called the Bloods. You may have heard of them, right? The Crips and the Bloods have different colored bandanas, but that's not the only bit. They sell drugs, they kill people, they mug, etc. This is a classic, typical American youth groups. Anyway, so the Crips and the Bloods have been in a state of horrific war. They actually have a truce. They declared a truce about a year ago. It was in the newspapers all over New Jersey. There's an actual official truce between the Crips and the Bloods, right? So this doesn't mean that the innocent bystander, right, is still open game, but they're not attacking each other. Anyway, the Crips and the Bloods. So now, let's say, God forbid, you were raised in the family of Crips. You were raised in the hood, in downtown Newark. This is an American term, the hood, right? And basically, you are one of the guys in the Crips. You've got your blue bandana, and you're walking down the street Sunday afternoon, minding your own business. You've got a 9mm Glock in the back of your pants. You've got a gravity knife in your left front pocket, and a collapsible steel nunchaku in a Velcro strap under your leather jacket, right? And you're not hurting anyone, just walking along, minding your own business. And anyway, nunchaku is a karate weapon, actually means rice flailer in Japanese. It's two sticks joined by a chain, which you whip around, etc. Right. Anyway, so you're walking along, not bothering anyone, and there, standing next to your crib, you see someone who's not one of your peeps. He appears to be representing another hood, right? So standing right next to your crib, that's your home, by the way, right, is a representative of another gang who is not a homie of yours, okay? I'm trying to put this into American terminology to make it crystal clear to you. So anyway, so now what happens is, as you see him, what goes through your mind? What is the free will decision that is going through your mind? What is the moral decision you're trying to make here? What decision are you making here? Which weapon? That is correct. Which weapon to use, right? It is not a question, he has to die, there's no question of that, right? The only question is how to kill him. So you decide on the nunchaku, right? So as you approach him stealthily from behind and you rip it out, he hears you and he turns around, and as he turns around, a picture falls out of his pocket with his girl and his baby. And as you see it, a human thought like comes into your mind, and you actually recognize, you know, and you say, and instead of going for a shot at the temple, you go for his collarbone. Was that a good decision or a bad decision? Now, don't misquote me here, okay? It's not like someone you don't know walks into the shul, like someone from the other shul, right? I wouldn't say breaking his collarbone is a good decision, right? This is a relatively good decision. You understand? It's relatively good. You don't have to give him an aliyah, but breaking his collarbone is not the right. So I see him. I say that, so the gang member has made a decision which is, I would say, a good decision, right? But you understand, it's very unlikely he'll make that decision, but he has, so in other words, what is he struggling with? Murder. If you would look at the diagram of London and Berlin, where is he fighting? Where is his trench? Where are his trenches? Well, no, Berlin would be good, the good people conquering everything, right? If his trenches would be right up at London. His back's to the wall, right? How much territory do the Germans have? Everything. You understand? His trenches are all the way back because he's struggling with something as basic as thou shalt not murder, right? Or as it's translated in the latest Ebonic Bible, don't waste nobody, right? So that is what he is struggling with. He's struggling with don't murder, okay? So therefore, yeah, is this clear? Now, you have a little higher up the scale, you've got a Boy Scout. The Boy Scouts in Boy Scout camp, there's Boy Scout camp in Catskills. Two of my kids went there one year. They have a kosher kitchen, they have a shul, right? A lot of Jewish scout crews go there, right? So you're standing guard. A lot of people are, let's say, they're on a hike, and you're standing guard at the tents to make sure animals don't get into the tents. And you're standing next to the scout troop from Lawrence, Long Island. They have a two-story tent with a jacuzzi on the top floor, right, leaks a bit, but otherwise, right, and the maid is cleaning up at the moment, right, and so basically, as I say, what does a Jewish woman in Lawrence have to know in order to run a household? Spanish. Okay, so now, therefore, you are watching the tent, right, and as you're watching the tent, right, you see in there But one of these scouts has left behind his state-of-the-art Swiss Army knife. I mean, the top-of-the-line Swiss Army knife. What's going through your mind now? I'm rationalizing. If I take it, I mean, he'll miss it for a bit, but you know what? His daddy will say, oh, you lost your Swiss Army knife. I'm going to take you to Switzerland next business trip on the Learjet, or the G5, sorry. Right, and we were G3, whatever. Right, and we'll get the latest experimental model from the factory. Right, so, you know, on the contrary, I'm doing the kid a favor. I start rationalizing. So what am I struggling with? Theft. My trenches are a little further along than the guy in Newark, aren't they? I wouldn't think of murdering. Right, but stealing maybe. A little higher up the scale. You've got a guy who's walking along, he's wearing his beautiful business suit, right, and his Hermes tie, right, and he's impeccably dressed. A thought of theft or murder never crossed his mind. However, a little reneging on agreements here and there, which were not really written, you know, and if they were, it was a little ambiguous, right, and telling the IRS, look, I have a family of 12 to support. Yes, they are gerbils, but they're like my own children, I'm telling you, right, so I'm claiming them as, you know, dependents, and so on and so forth, right, that type of stuff, right, so maybe he'd do it, correct? So his trenches, where they're a little further along, aren't they? He's not murdering, he's not outright ripping you off, you know, thrilling you up, but it's pretty bad. A little further up the scale, let's go way up the scale. There's a story of a Hasidic Rebbe, a small town in Europe. Always famous Hasidic Rebbes in small towns in Europe. Now, you never have mediocre Rebbes in large metropolises, do you? Never hear. Why is that? What, there were no Rebbes in big cities? They're always a little staple. Anyway, so okay, but this Rebbe, he's waiting, there's people waiting there. Guy comes in and he says, the Gabbai says, serving number 13. Right? And so he gives the ticket to the Rebbe. And the Rebbe says, yeah, what does it mean? And he says, listen, he says, my daughter's going to marry, he says, Mazel Tov. He says, I need 400 rubles for the wedding. The Rebbe says, whew, that's a lot of money. Look, I've got to think about this. How to get that money, that's a lot of money. Let me think. He says, go into the waiting room. Guy goes into the waiting room. Next guy comes in. Next guy says, listen, Rabbi, he says, I just made 4,000 ruble on the Warsaw Stock Exchange. I want to give 10% to the stocker. You do with it what you feel fit. Gives the Rebbe 400 rubles, and he walks out. The Rebbe says, cool, or Yiddish, whatever the equivalent is. And the guy comes back in, and the Rebbe says, you know, he's handing in the 400 rubles. And the guy says, oh, it's a miracle, it's unbelievable. And he's about to take the rubles, and the Rebbe pulls it back, and he says, whoa, go outside, let me think about this again. The guy says, well, he was touching them. Now he's really depressed, because beforehand he didn't even have a hope. And now he almost had it. The Rebbe's sitting there counting the rubles, and he's thinking. And then, a few minutes later, he calls the guy back in and says, here, take the money. The guy takes it and runs. So now, the Gabbai asks the Rebbe, what's going on? First you said, oh, this is unbelievable, divine providence, the guy needs 400, someone walks in and gives me 400, I'm just a pipeline for God's benevolence. But then you changed your mind, you took it away, and then you changed your mind again and gave it back to him. What's going on? The Rebbe says, very simple. My first thought was, it is indeed divine providence, and I am merely a shliach, an agent of God, in giving him the money. But I had a second thought. The second thought was, don't give it all to him. Maybe there's other people who have weddings, so he'll have two weddings, 200 rubles each. Much more. Many places can say that Kiddushin actually is chal without a shmog. Kiddushin can take effect without it, not without a photographer, but without a shmog, it can't take effect, right? So, I researched this extensively. This is another incredible leniency that I've researched in Shas and Poskim. Right? It is permitted to invite someone to your wedding, even if they didn't invite you to yours, invite you to theirs. I know it's an incredible leniency, but I mean, it's permitted. You can invite someone to your simcha even if they did not invite you to theirs, right? I have actually not found the issa for this yet, but okay. Right, anyway, so now what happens is, right, the Rebbe said, my second thought was, yeah, maybe I shouldn't give it all to him. Yeah, don't give it all to him, distribute it. 400 people in Warsaw can have a happy meal today if I give them 1 ruble each, kosher, right? 1 ruble each, right? So maybe I should do that. So he says, I didn't know what to do. Which is the right thing to do? What? So he says, finally I decided that, you know what, the second thought came to me, I figured that was from the Yetzer Hara, evil inclination. You know why? Because it started with the words, don't give it to him. In other words, I felt a little bit of meanness in that. So I decided to distribute it, just to give it all to him. Is this clear? So now, the Rebbe, does he have free will? What is free will? How best to distribute the charity, correct? Okay, now if you go down the ladder, the business guy that I'm talking about before, he's standing there thinking, how can I do this so I don't have to pay capital gains tax on this gift, and I can also get a tax exemption from the charity, and maybe I can get the wedding made stenciled on the wedding dress sponsored by Goldberg Furniture or something like that. Right? But a little further down, the scout is saying, hey, maybe I can get a finder's fee. You know what I mean? Like if I get 50 ruble, he gets 350, everyone's happy. Right? The guy in Newark is thinking, how can I get the other 3,600 rubles from that guy from Warsaw? Right? So everyone's got their different free will. You understand? Everyone's got a different point of free will. The trenches are different. So but if someone down the scale looks at the Rebbe, he'll look at the Rebbe and say, this guy doesn't have free will. The Rebbe might look at the guy in Newark and say he doesn't have free will. They both have free will, but their trenches, where the struggle is totally different for every person. And, by the way, in different areas, you may have different struggles in different areas. In other words, if it may be between your relationship with other people. You're way over at Berlin, meaning you've conquered a tremendous amount of territory. You are wonderful, sensitive, very good with other people. When it comes to your relationship with God, you're struggling with London. With some people, it's the reverse. They're fantastic with God, other people, I'm so great. Some people, it's with finance, some people, it's with, you know, everyone's got free will. But, you know, I had a Rebbe in Israel. You know, he was unbelievable masmid. He always was learning, always, unbelievable. So one, you know, it was before the first vacation, called Bein Hazmanim vacation, the yeshiva. So I remember the class before the end of the term, he sits there and he says, I love Bein Hazmanim. And we were all like, oh! Like, we were shocked. And he says, I can learn any Masechta I want. He could learn any tractate he wants. He doesn't have to learn the tractate that he's teaching in the yeshiva. He can learn, for him, yeah, we're all like, our minds already a month before, we're on, we'll go hike here, and then we'll stay at this kibbutz, and then we'll go to the beach there. And he is like, I love it, every Masechta I want. But different, you know, same yeshiva, different planets. Right. So, but that is how it is. And so indeed, when we talk about someone who is a rosha, an evil person, what that means is that they're living in the sphere of evil. That is to say, all their decisions are between good and evil. If they're the rosha, all their decisions are between the lesser of two evils. Shall I break his collarbone or shall I kill him? Okay? If you're a Beinoni, like most of us, intermediate, what are our decisions between good and evil? If you're a tzaddik, righteous, what are your decisions? Between good and better than. Our goal, ultimately, in every area is to try and conquer more and more territory. So something which I was struggling with 2 years ago, right, and I was struggling between the lesser of two evils, okay, you know what, I guess I can get away with that, or I can get away with this, right, now it should be between good and evil, and guess what, eventually it should be between the lesser of two evils. If I was struggling with theft, ultimately I should get to a level where I'm struggling with how best to distribute my charity, like that Rebbe. That's the ideal. And as Rav Nachman of Breslov, I'm just quoting here from the Likutei Moharan, he says, the purpose of free will is to eliminate free will. What do you think that means? The goal of having free will is that I should be moving the trenches further and further and further and further to the point where, to all intents and purposes, most people who would view me would say, that's not free will. He's just choosing between good and better than. But that's what it's meant to be. Right? To choose between good and better than, to live in the sphere of good and not to live in the sphere of evil. And I've got to stop now because the next lecturer I cannot afford to make her empty. My wife is teaching now. So, anyway, we'll stop now. Thank you very much for coming. And my wife will be teaching right here and now, same bat time, same bat channel.